and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this first day of testimony before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection and speak with Will Sommer, who covered the events on that day. He is a reporter covering tech and conservative media for The Daily Beast and is the co-host of the podcast Fever Dreams and is currently writing a book on QAnon. We'll discuss his latest article at The Daily Beast, Republicans Recast January the 6th Riot Defendants as Political Prisoners, and the extent of trolling coming from Republicans in lockstep with Trump as they try to create an alternative version of reality and cast these white supremacists, neo-Confederates, and QAnon seditionists as martyrs and patriots. Congressman Matt Gaetz and the QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene went to the steps of the Department of Justice today in support of those in jail for the many crimes committed on that day, and we will assess how their protest went. Then we'll speak with Sidney Blumenthal, the former senior White House aide, now a biography of Abraham Lincoln, whose latest book is All the Powers on Earth, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1856 to 1860. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, What Did Jim Jordan Know About the Insurrection and When Did He Know It?, and today's powerful testimony from two Capitol Hill police officers and two D.C. Metro policemen who faced the raging and murderous mob of Trump supporters. Then finally, we'll speak with John Boniface, the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director of the general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute. His organization, along with a group of constitutional lawyers, contacted election officials in 50 states to remind them that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment bars formerly elected officials like Donald Trump who engage in insurrection from again holding public office. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Will Sommer, a reporter covering tech and conservative media for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill, the co-host of the podcast Fever Dreams. He is currently writing a book on QAnon, and his latest article at The Daily Beast is Republicans Recast January the 6th Riot Defendants as Political Prisoners. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Sommer.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Will. And you actually covered the January the 6th insurrection. You were there with the crowd and you're a firsthand witness. What did you think of the hearings today with the four police officers, two from the Capitol Police and two from D.C. Metro?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was damning testimony. I think even as someone who was there, you know, I only had, you know, sort of what I could see and you know, really to have the full sense of the ferocity and the violence of that day laid out at the hearing today, I think was really effective, especially when we see that Republicans, you know, are interested in doing everything they can to downplay the severity of what happened on January 6th, you know, doing things like saying it was just a bunch of tourists or people just wandering through the halls.
So obviously, the Republicans are doing their best to troll Pelosi and then actually calling the two Republicans on the select committee. They're calling them Pelosi Republicans, Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. What happened today, though, on the steps of the DOJ?
Yeah, so this is a funny one. So as you said, Republicans are for the most part boycotting the committee after Nancy Pelosi refused to see Jim Jordan and another member chosen by Kevin McCarthy. And so we had sort of the fringiest of the fringe in terms of Republican lawmakers. We had folks like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And they were on the steps of the Justice Department demanding sort of pushing a bunch of fringe issues. And so they were saying, you know, claiming that the January 6th defendants are being abused in jail, something that, you know, obviously would be terrible, but there's no evidence of that that's come out. And then also demanding that all of the surveillance footage from the January 6th be released so that they can essentially hunt for proof that it was all Antifa or that it was, a deep state activity. But unfortunately for them, they didn't get a chance to make that case because they were disrupted by protesters, including a man with a whistle, something as simple as that. Basically, he kept whistling. And so they called off their rally.
Well, apparently they, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, along with Paul Gosar and Louis Gohmert, apparently they've written a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland asking for a meeting. Has he agreed to a meeting with them?
He has not. And, you know, I did think this was funny in that letter. They said, okay, we're willing to meet with you between noon and 3 on Tuesday. Like, it was really like they were the ones, you know, sort of in the position of power. And obviously, I think he ignored that.
Well, there's a real possibility that Gosar was one of the congressmen, along with Lauren Boebert, of organizing these tours, these reconnaissance tours that took place prior to January the 6th.
Yeah, you know, I think there's still a lot up in the air on that. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to, accuse anyone of being involved in that until it's proven. But certainly these are people who are very friendly with these elements. I mean, we know Marjorie Taylor Greene is a one-time, and I would suspect perhaps still a QAnon believer. Paul Gosar is really, you know, friendly with really extremist elements. You know, he did a fundraiser or planned to do a fundraiser with an out-and-out white nationalist who marched in Charlottesville. So really these are... some of the most extreme people in Congress, and, you know, ones who, in the case of Paul Gosar, potentially could come out looking pretty bad based on what the January 6th commission finds.
And how do you think they're doing apart from being inside the echo chamber of Fox and Newsmax and OAN? Is this alternative universe expanding in terms of their alternative narrative on the big steal and now this new narrative that these insurgents who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th are actually patriots who are out on a picnic. And as Trump said in an interview with the two Washington Post reporters, it was just a loving, loving experience.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think certainly within the Republican Party and especially among hardcore Trump supporters, the idea that January 6th was either, and maybe they can believe both of these things at once, but that it was either, basically harmless, or maybe a patriotic act even, or that it was, you know, the people were put up to it by these agent provocateurs that they imagine. I think a lot of people on the right believe that. On the other hand, I think I don't see that message really catching on outside of that echo chamber. And I think the decision by Republicans to boycott the committee, is going to allow the committee, hopefully, just in terms of those of us who would like to see it find out what happened, I think it's going to give it more power because, you know, we've seen in the past with these committees, like the investigation into Donald Trump's ties to Russia, for example, we see that the Republicans on the committee often just sort of grandstand and pursue their own conspiracy theories rather than sort of participating in the investigative process. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in this case.
And again, I'm speaking with Will Sommer, a reporter covering tech and conservative media for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill. He's the co-host of the podcast Fever Dreams, and he's currently writing a book on QAnon. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is Republicans Recast January the 6th Riot Defendants as Political Prisoners. Now, I saw that Gosar in House testimony went to bat for Ashley Babbitt, the woman that was shot trying to break into where the Capitol Police were plainclothesmen were protecting these congressmen and women who were just hunkered down. And that was the last barrier. And she tried to break that and was shot dead. They're trying to turn her into a martyr. Gosar demanded to know the name of the Capitol Police officer who shot her. Trump also joined in that. It's a rather nasty subterfuge on their part. They're not interested in justice. They're just interested in causing trouble, aren't they? I mean, what good would it do to release the name of the policeman apart from put his life in danger?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to imagine what good it would do, as you say. I mean, I think this is part of this effort, you know, and we see this often when sort of a big instance happens on the right that makes them look really badly, that they distance themselves from it. And then maybe a year or a couple months later, they come back and try to recast the narrative. So I think about Charlottesville, for example, and they said, they tried to act like these were not Trump supporters. And then since then, they said they come back and say, well, Trump didn't really say they were really fine people or very fine people, you know, something we all saw. And so they really try to just make this whole a separate narrative that at least their supporters can believe in. And so in this case, we see that initially there was this effort to, act like the protesters really were, you know, that there were a couple bad troublemakers and stuff and everyone else was innocent. But now, you know, we see that, this effort to say that it really was this very bland day, and that the people who are in jail on violent offenses, that they are that these are these innocent patriots who were simply trying to protect their country.
So one of the more prominent of the insurrectionists was this character, Richard Big O Barnett, the Arkansas character who put his feet up on Pelosi's desk, and Putin actually made a hero out of him, and Russian media has. But apparently his attorney, Joseph McBride, according to your article, Will, is now trying to turn him into a martyr and suggesting that he's being harassed and assaulted by guards in custody and beaten and dragged and hogtied and had his pants dropped down in front of a female officer. Is there any evidence here? I mean, I know that we are in a evidence-free zone here when it comes to a lot of these people, but are they offering any evidence? I'm sure his followers believe it.
Sure. But I mean, absolutely. So we've seen this, you know, this is odd that this is coming in out now, because Barnett has been out of jail pending trial since April. But basically, his attorney last week went on Newsmax and said, you know, really alleged these very lurid allegations. He claimed that guards were taking the prisoners, the January 6th prisoners, out one by one and beating them. You know, he claimed that his client's pants fell down and he was embarrassed, and that really just like this tough and really vile accusations. With that said, no other proof has come out of this. I mean, you would think there might be pictures of the bruises, or that this lawyer would be willing to offer some sort of evidence. I contacted him and asked for evidence. None was provided. But nonetheless, this interview is being cited as, you know, gospel truth on the right. And this idea, you know, including by the congressman we mentioned, and this idea has really spread that the prisoners are being subjected to these just like really baroque tortures. They're saying the line is that this is worse than Guantanamo Bay or worse than Abu Ghraib, which I think, absent any other evidence, is obviously ridiculous.
And what happened at this group rally, I guess, on Sunday in New York, organized by a group called Citizens Against Political Prosecution? I take it that this is also a part of this kind of movement to rewrite history and to cast those arrested for the January 6th insurrection as martyrs and patriots.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, in both Washington and New York, we've seen these groups, you know, a couple dozen people each time gather and, call for this attempt to suggest that, the big line is they say they're political prisoners. And so they say the people who are still in jail are political prisoners, and the defendants as well. So in this case, in New York, we saw some of the people who had been charged in January 6th come out. And we saw their lawyers who, you know, continue to make these kind of really outrageous claims about their treatment in jail, which everyone latches onto and then, you know, says, oh, how terrible that, you know, anyone is being punished for January 6th.
So just in closing then, Will Sommer, since you were there on that day and you covered it and you were in the crowd, and the contrast between what you saw and what we've all seen on video, and there was new video played today in this Select Committee hearing that featured testimony from the two Capitol Police officers and the two D.C. Metro officers, who were very emotional, and indeed the two Republicans were quite forceful, both Liz Cheney and particular Kinzinger, who broke down congratulating the police officers for holding the line and in effect saving his life. So I thought it was that there was some very powerful stuff. And again, you just wonder, because of the way we are so divided in this country, and particularly divided by media, that particularly on the right, that reinforces already pre-existing beliefs. Do you think they can really gaslight this thing away? It was such a powerful event. So many people saw it. At least I imagine they did. What's your feeling on whether it can be sort of gaslit away, that what we actually saw on that day, which was so horrible, now, you know, we've got Trump saying it was beautiful, it was loving, and the police were being hugged by these insurrectionists?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I think, though, that maybe the diagnosis here may be positive, and that I think the efforts to sort of to rewrite what happened on January 6th have mostly failed outside of, I think, the Trump hardcore. I mean, maybe this 30-35% of people in the country who will always support him no matter what. I think outside of that, I do think January 6th has broken through as this, you know, really shocking moment. That indeed, I think is a pivot point for our country in terms of what way we go after that. So I do think that the attempts to sort of create a counter narrative to January 6th have mostly failed outside of really the most devoted Trump supporters.
And on that day, did you see anybody that looked like they're from Antifa or Black Lives Matter?
No, I did not. You know, I saw just, you know, mobs and mobs of angry Trump supporters. I saw a photographer getting beaten up because people claimed he was Antifa, but he was with the Associated Press. I mean, I saw a lot of violence, unfortunately, and, you know, it seems like it was even worse closer up. So really, it's frankly disgusting. I think, you know, as someone who was there to see the attempts to downplay what was, you know, really a shocking incident. You know, people died, obviously. You know, it was not a walk in the park.
And you were lucky to escape, right? You just sort of blended in. Is that how you weren't singled out like your colleague from the Associated Press who got beaten and these cameras were taken?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, after I saw that, I saw him getting beaten up and sort of ejected, and then I was with another reporter, and I said, well, you know, we can't go any closer there. And frankly, because of my reporting, in particular on QAnon, you know, I have been harassed in the past, and you know, I just felt that, you know, the police obviously had better things to do than prevent any harm from coming to me. So I did hang back. You know, on one hand, I wish I could have gotten closer and do more reporting, but obviously it was a very violent day, and you know, it certainly was a very intense situation.
And you know a lot of those QAnon people, right? You're writing a book about it.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, including the guy with the coyote skin and the horns.
Yeah, and in fact, yeah, he's you know, he's a big character in the book. I mean, he's a guy who I have been dealing with or had been aware of for many months before January 6th, and it was truly surreal to be in the scrum outside the Capitol and be looking on my phone and be like, oh my gosh, the Q shaman has, you know, taken over the Senate. Yeah, the book is called Trust the Plan, and it's coming out in March, and you know, really a lot of these characters are in it, and you know, everything else aside, it was, you know, January 6th, I think, was a real triumph for QAnon as a movement. They really saw it as sort of the apocalyptic moment they were hoping for.
Well, Will Sommer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Sommer, who's a reporter covering tech and conservative media for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill. He's the co-host of the podcast Fever Dreams and is currently writing a book on QAnon. And his latest article, The Daily Beast, is Republicans Recast January the 6th Riot Defendants as Political Prisoners. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's powerful testimony. And what did Jim Jordan know about the insurrection, and when did he know it?
Our values are under attack now, and the bad guys get the benefits. The rest of us pay their way. Patriots are under attack just for having their say. While I'm riding down Freedom Road, agents on my tail. You wave a flag on Christmas Day, they'll throw you in jail. Hey!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sidney Blumenthal, the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He has been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and his books include the best-selling The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. His latest book is All the Powers on Earth, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1856 to 1860. And he has an article at The Guardian, What Did Jim Jordan Know About the Insurrection, and When Did He Know It? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sidney Blumenthal.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
So in terms of the Watergate question, the rhetorical question that you're posing there, I don't know that we'll necessarily find out about Jim Jordan's role, but earlier Liz Cheney on the steps of the Capitol said that he could be a material witness. So that's pretty provocative. Do you think he's going to be called as a material witness?
The chairman of the House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection, Benny Thompson, was asked that question, not specifically about Jordan, but about other all members of Congress who might be deposed. And he said, nobody's off limits. I would assume Jim Jordan will be called if I had to speculate. And the reason is that he was involved in the planning, coordination, and defense of the insurrection on January 6th. And there are many unanswered questions about it, but the documentation of his involvement in the planning and his connection to Republican organizations and the White House and Trump himself is indisputable.
In some of the testimony that from the police to Capitol Police and to D.C. Metro Police were very, very powerful. And in her opening remarks, Liz Cheney said to those testifying, the four police officers, you held the line, you defended us all, you defended the Capitol, and you defended the Constitution and our republic, and every American owes you our undying gratitude. And Adam Kinzinger got emotional also when talking to the police who were testifying about how they held the line. But what Liz Cheney said in her opening statement, I wanted to get your comment on. She said, on January the 6th and in the days thereafter, almost all members of my party recognized the events of that day for what they actually were. One Republican, for example, said, quote, what is happening at the U.S. Capitol right now is unacceptable and un-American. Those participating in lawlessness and violence must be arrested and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. My guess is that person who said that was Kevin McCarthy. What do you think, Sidney?
Well, Kevin McCarthy denounced the attack, and not only that, but he called Donald Trump while the assault on the Capitol was taking place, and Trump told him, now we know where you stand on things, paraphrasing, and McCarthy responded, who the F do you think you're talking to? And then after the insurrection, he denounced it. But then he went and visited Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And even before then, he defended Donald Trump in the second impeachment, for which Trump was impeached for incitement of the insurrection. So McCarthy has done a complete 180 on this, and we are not hearing from him any statements or from any other prominent Republican leaders now denouncing the insurrection and asking for an unimpeded investigation of the role of anybody involved in it from top to bottom.
Well, the testimony from the police officers was searing and raw, and one would think it would get to the American people. I don't know what kind of numbers, what people are watching, and of course the Republicans are actively trolling the whole operation. But Officer Harry Dunn of the Capitol Police described the despicable racism of the MAGA crowd with this woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelling at him, "You hear that, guys? This N-word voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd of about 20 people joined in screaming, "Boo, N-word, N-word." No one had ever called me a N-word while wearing the uniform of the Capitol Police officer, said Harry Dunn, who was finding it difficult to compose himself, as was Aquilino Gunnell, another Capitol Police officer, who described being physically attacked by the mob and saying, "I could feel myself losing oxygen, and I recall thinking to myself, this is how I am going to die, defending this entrance." So we all saw it. Now, we're all being gaslit by the Republicans, is it going to work? I mean, or is this just an example of the legacy of Rupert Murdoch, that he's allowed this Pravda of the Republican Party, this alternative media universe, to create an alternative narrative that has become the accepted truth of what, we don't know what the real numbers are, but it's perhaps as many as 30% of American people?
The reason that the Republican leadership and the Republican Party does not want an investigation in why they did not cooperate, and then why they named Jim Jordan and Jim Banks to be members of the select committee in order to disrupt it and to try and prevent it from doing its business, which Nancy Pelosi rejected. The reason is that the Republican Party knows that if the truth is pursued, it will lead to the Trump White House. It will lead to many people at the top of the Trump White House. It will lead to Donald Trump. They also know it will lead to many Republican organizations, including the Republican Attorneys General Association, which helped fund and promote the January 6th insurrection. And there were many other groups involved. And they know that there were members of Congress who were involved in the planning and coordination of this event, who may well be deposed, including Jim Jordan, who has many questions to answer. And they know, and Jim Jordan, among others, knows that he participated in meetings at the White House and in calls with members of the White House on organizing the January 6th rally and events, and how to choreograph it. So that's why the Republicans don't want this investigated, because it takes the mask off the Republican Party and shows what really happened and who they really are.
And again, I'm speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, a former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and a senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He has been a national staff reporter for the Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for the New Yorker, and his books include the bestsellers The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. His latest book is All the Powers on Earth, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1856 to 1860. And he has an article in The Guardian, What Did Jim Jordan Know About the Insurrection and When Did He Know It? So let's talk about the meetings that you mentioned. You're talking about the White House meeting on December the 21st with Jim Jordan, Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs, and the QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, where they plotted the insurrection for the very date of the certification of the vote, January the 6th. They snacked on pigs in a blanket. And what do we know about that meeting apart from the menu?
Well, we know a number of things. We know that Jim Jordan was involved in the creation and the propagation of the Stop the Steal myth, the big lie, the idea that the presidential election was a fraud and stolen by Joe Biden and the Democrats, and that Trump was the true winner. He participated in a rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, before the state capitol there, a Stop the Steal rally with an activist cited by the Southern Poverty Law Center as on their hate watch list. Somebody who participated in the crowd on January 6th. What was Jordan's relationship to this person? What was his staff's relationship? He participated in a number of calls and private meetings at the White House, where, according to Politico, they strategized over the last ditch effort to overturn the election results. And what was said at that meeting? What were the plans? And was Jim Jordan's role discussed for January 6th when he stood on the floor of the House and falsely claimed that the election was a fraud and that the presidential electors from Arizona should not be certified or accepted, and therefore the whole election should be overturned. He participated in calls on January 2nd with Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, who had also worked with him in the House Freedom Caucus when Meadows was in the House, and 50 other House members and senators to discuss overturning the election. What did they say? Then Jordan went out and started broadcasting the Stop the Steal falsehoods. Was he trying to encourage attendance and participation on January 6th in Washington? We know that the political director in the White House, Brian Jack, who is now Kevin McCarthy's political director, helped organize the January 6th events. What was his relationship to Jim Jordan and the others? What's the relationship between Jim Jordan and the Republican Attorneys General Association? There are a number of Democratic members of Congress who say that they observed Republican members giving, quote, tours to large groups of people who they later identified as among the insurrectionists through the Capitol before January 6th. Were these reconnaissance missions? Who was involved? What does Jim Jordan and the Republican leadership know about these people? Why are they being protected? Will they be deposed? These are just a few of the questions that need to be answered. And they have to be answered under oath by, among others, various Republican members of Congress, not least Jim Jordan.
Well, the people that are involved here, the ones that are suspected of leading these tours, Bobbitt being one of them, the QAnon woman, and Paul Gosar another, whose own family have all denounced him and disowned him. I mean, you've got to look at these people and wonder what's happened to the GOP. It's become a kind of, Bobbitt's got a rap sheet. Her husband was arrested for exposing himself in front of a bowling alley to a line of queue of young teenage girls waiting in line. I mean, these people are pretty awful. And then the other guy, that, by the way, that Nancy Pelosi wouldn't allow on the panel, along with Jordan, Jim Banks of Indiana, he went down to the border for one of these photo ops that they've been doing, trolling Biden. He went down there with one of these characters who was arrested and indicted for the January 6th riot. So let's talk a little bit about January the 11th, when Trump awarded Jim Jordan the highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, in a closed ceremony at the White House. My understanding, Sydney, is that prior to that, the few sensible White House aides left were trying to convince Trump to award Pence the Presidential Medal of Freedom because they were trying to heal the rift, because after all, Trump had put a target on Pence's back by denouncing him to the rally on January the 6th, and then when they stormed the Capitol, they were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." And of course, Trump did what Trump did, right? Defiantly, instead of healing the rift with his vice president, he awarded the highest civilian honor to this bomb thrower buddy, Jim Jordan.
We know what happened on January 6th. The significance of January 11th, the day that Donald Trump, in a secret closed ceremony at the White House, awarded Jim Jordan the Presidential Medal of Freedom, is that was the same day that an article of impeachment was filed in the House against Trump for incitement of insurrection and led to Trump's second impeachment trial. So he was giving this award to Jim Jordan, who was going to be his chief defender during that trial, in the hearings, disrupting them, and on the floor during the trial. He was going to be on Fox News and all the right-wing media. The story of Jim Jordan is really a story about the degradation and degeneration of the Republican Party, and he has played a major role in it. He was somebody who, when the Republicans gained power after the Tea Party wins in 2010, constantly harassed the Republican Speaker John Boehner, who was a regular Republican, and eventually forced him to quit. Boehner called him a legislative terrorist, and the people that Jordan was involved with as anarchists and seeking to create total chaos. So they drove him out, and they have been operating as terrorists against anybody, including now Kevin McCarthy. He's really lives in fear of Jim Jordan and his crowd in the House. And that crowd in the House was part of the important base for Donald Trump. And they were not only precursors of Trump, they were his chief defenders. And they are now his chief defenders after he's left and leading the Republican Party in a downward spiral. And that is why Kevin McCarthy, who was really not a full leader of the minority in the House, but more the finger puppet of Jim Jordan, named Jordan and Banks to the Select Committee precisely in order to try and upset it and to distract.
Well, just in closing, Sidney Blumenthal, the ultimate terrorist, of course, is former President Trump, who controls the Republican Party and has basically created this litmus test. If you don't believe in Stop the Steal, you're dead meat. I mean, you can see the kind of people he's endorsing and will endorse for the 2022 elections. And, of course, the efforts on the part of the Republicans who'd rather cheat than compete are so clear that they have created a rigged playing field for 2022 and 2024 elections. And that's where, I mean, here at this radio network I broadcast from, Pacifica, they just had a referendum, and the incumbents who run the network into the ground are just behaving like Trump. They refuse to accept the results and pretend they won an election they lost. But what the Democrats are facing is absolutely make or break, isn't it? I mean, how can they accept that this rigged playing field entering an election? I don't know what they can do, but I cannot see the point of participating in an election that is so brazenly rigged against you.
Well, the Republicans have followed Trump downward, even since January 6th, rather than reversing themselves and attempting to learn a lesson. And the unifying principle now of the Republican Party, which, as far as I can see, exists in a state of fear and loathing, is opposition to democracy. The Republican Party today is the only political party in the West, and I mean, you know, in European, Western European parties, conservative parties, that is actively seeking to undermine democracy as a principle. And this is their main principle right now. What they have learned from January 6th is not that they need to do everything that they can to make sure that there are no further threats to democracy, but rather they have learned what the potential weaknesses are in the system and how to exploit them for their own partisan advantage the next time out. And so they are seeking to undermine democracy in the states and the localities across the country with all sorts of voter suppression, and the ultimate suppression is election suppression. And these hearings are very much connected to all of these larger issues and to the fate of democracy itself in the United States.
Well, Sidney Blumenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, as a former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for the Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for the New Yorker, and his books include the bestsellers The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. His latest book is All the Powers on Earth, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1856 to 1860, and he has an article at The Guardian, What Did Jim Jordan Know About the Insurrection? And when did he know it? We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how a group of constitutional lawyers contacted election officials in 50 states to remind them that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment bars formerly elected officials like Donald Trump, who engaged in insurrection, from holding public office. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, John Boniface, who is the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as the legal director of Voter Action, a distinguished attorney who has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles across the country for more than two decades and is the winner of the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Award. He's the co-author of The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Boniface.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your organization, Free Speech for People, along with a group of constitutional lawyers, have been contacting election officials in all 50 states to remind them about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which bars formerly elected officials who engaged in an insurrection from again holding public office. Now, we've had the first day of testimony from the Select Committee on the investigating the insurrection. So what is the line there, John, in terms of who could be found guilty or at least be stripped of their congressional seats under the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? What's the bar?
Well, so first we should address the fact that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which of course was part of the 14th Amendment enacted after the Civil War, was designed to address the Confederates seeking to continue to hold public office or seek other public office after having engaged in insurrection. And there was a decision made to include language in the 14th Amendment that would bar them from ever holding future public office. Several years after the enactment of the 14th Amendment, the Congress unfortunately granted amnesty to all those Confederates and effectively undermined the very purpose of that section. But it only applied to the Confederates and did not apply going forward to those who might take an oath of office and then engage in insurrection. The other point I'd make is that the language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment not only covers those who have taken an oath of office and then engaged in insurrection, but who have given aid or comfort to insurrectionists. And so what we do know is that former President Donald Trump incited this insurrection. The facts make that very clear. And he is covered by having taken an oath of office and engaged in insurrection. But we also know there were many others who gave aid or comfort to the insurrection, including those in Congress who fomented the big lie. And after this insurrection took place, they went back into the Congress and they sought to overturn the election results from November 2020. So there are unfortunately many elected officials who took that oath of office and then gave aid or comfort to the insurrection. The final category are those who actually participated in going into the Capitol during that insurrection, who were elected officials and who had taken an oath of office at the state or local level. They too are covered by this constitutional provision.
So, for example, what was it, about 134 House members voted against the certification of the election even after the storming of the Capitol? Are all of those people liable?
Well, I think secretaries of state and chief election officials ought to make that decision when they seek to be placed on the ballot again. Were they giving aid or comfort to the insurrectionists? I think there's a very strong argument that they were, that what they were doing after this violence had occurred, after this seditious attack on the U.S. Capitol had occurred, that they went back into the House chamber and they went ahead and endorsed that insurrection, gave aid or comfort to it by voting to overturn the election results. It's worth noting that members of the Senate, after the insurrection, some of them chose not to continue that and that effort to overturn the election results. So I do think that this needs to be determined by secretaries of state and chief election officials. They have a duty to follow the mandate of the Constitution and determine who is qualified and who is not. And we know if you're running for president of the United States, you have to be 35 years of age by the time you take the oath of office for the presidency. You have to be a naturalized citizen. You have to be living in the country for 14 years at least. And you have to not have taken an oath of office and then turned around and incited an insurrection. That we know.
And again, I'm speaking with John Boniface, who's the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as a legal director of Voter Action. A distinguished attorney, he has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles across the country for more than two decades and is the winner of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Award. And he is the co-author of The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. So, what about people like Senator Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, who actually, on the floor of the Senate just before it was overrun by the insurgents, tried to stop the certification, as did Jim Jordan from the House, tried to stop the certification of the Arizona vote? They would seem to be even more liable, aren't they?
Well, they're certainly liable. I wouldn't put them as having greater liability than Donald Trump, but they're certainly liable as well. Look, the reality here is that this insurrection was instigated by Donald Trump and his associates and their fomenting of this big lie that in fact the election in November 2020 was fraudulent. That was a lie that was repeatedly told by them and others, and that led to thousands of people coming to the Capitol on January 6th, storming the Capitol with this violent, seditious attack. So when we speak about accountability, and it's important that this House Select Committee has gotten underway, part of that accountability includes whether we allow these insurrectionists and those who aided and gave comfort to these insurrectionists to ever hold public office again. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment makes clear that they cannot.
So not long after that vote was taken that we mentioned, where I think it was 135 Republicans in the House, even though they saw how close they came, their lives were at risk, how they were hunkered down and protected by a very thin blue line of Capitol Police, and many of them were terrified, and some were justifiably terrified, since people like AOC and Nancy Pelosi, the crowd were calling for their execution along with hanging Mike Pence. So it was a very serious matter, but very shortly thereafter, again, I'm not sure the exact figure, but I think it was 134 Republicans in the House voted against the certification of Biden's victory. Shortly thereafter, Representative Cori Bush offered up a resolution directing the Committee on Ethics to investigate. And she wanted those committees to issue a report on whether any or all of the actions taken by members of the 117th Congress who sought to overturn the 2020 presidential election violated their oath of office to uphold the Constitution or the rules of the House of Representatives, and that they should face sanctions, including removal from the House of Representatives. So what happened to that resolution? Because it seems to be so incredibly clear that you can't belong to a body that you basically have joined those who wanted to destroy that body. You've chosen the side of those insurrectionists who assaulted your house instead of those who defended it.
Well, first I should say that Congresswoman Bush is to be congratulated for issuing that resolution so soon after the insurrection. We were one of many groups that issued a sign-on letter in support of the resolution. It remains pending, and it needs to be taken up by the House. We fully agree with what she presented to the House. Anyone who sought to give aid and comfort to this insurrection, who voted to overturn the legitimate results of the November 2020 election, does not deserve to remain in Congress. They effectively went against their oath of office, which is to uphold and defend the Constitution. That includes defending the right to vote. And instead, they sought to trample on the right to vote of millions of Americans by seeking to overturn the election in November 2020, which, again, there was no evidence whatsoever of any fraud. This was a legitimate election with legitimate results reported, and Joe Biden is a legitimately elected president of the United States. And yet they fomented this big lie, and they sought to overturn those legitimate results. They do not deserve to maintain their office in the House of Representatives.
So do you think that they're doing it because they genuinely believe that Joe Biden wasn't democratically elected and didn't win a majority of 7 million more popular votes than Trump? And he also won, of course, in the Electoral College. Are they doing it because they genuinely don't believe it, or they're doing it because it is a very cynical tactic to undermine the ability of this Biden administration and the Democrats to get anything done? And that seems to be a pattern in the destructive politics in our divided country, that, you know, we know that McConnell and others, Gingrich and company, met on the very day of Obama's inauguration and plotted his downfall. And McConnell said he was determined to make him a one-term president. And more recently, McConnell said that he's 100% focused on stopping the Biden administration. So is this the politics of sabotage to delegitimize the Democrats? Or do these people genuinely believe, without evidence, I might add, that Trump somehow won?
I actually do believe that it's more of a strategy to effectively defy what the people have expressed at the ballot box and to try to undermine this Biden administration. But I would go further and say they're doing it because they fear Donald Trump. They fear the primary challengers that they might face from the seditious right wing, further right-wing aspects of the Republican Party who would run against them and effectively unseat them because they are more aligned with Donald Trump than the person who perhaps voted to uphold this legitimate election. So, and certify the election results. So I think it's a combination, but there is a lot of fear among those members of Congress that if they cross Donald Trump, they will face their own primary challengers.
So just in closing then, John Boniface, given that Trump is sort of terrorizing them and maybe they're falling in line because they don't want to be primaried, nevertheless, it seems across the board, given how many Republican state legislatures are passing these voter suppression laws, and the Republicans essentially have got it so sewn up in terms of voter suppression that they will win the House before one vote is cast through gerrymandering. On Election Day, they will win because of the many levels of voter suppression that they put into the laws and made it so difficult for Democrats to vote. And then once the votes are cast through these partisan Republican legislatures, they get to count and certify the vote. And then if they don't like the vote, they can change the results. And then on top of that, they've also been harassing neutral poll workers. A recent poll had 50% of poll workers saying they feel threatened in this country. And a lot of those people are resigning and quitting and being replaced by the kind of partisan Republicans we see in Arizona doing that bogus Cyber Ninjas recount. So the bottom line, it seems to me, John, is that the Republicans have made a, the Trump Republicans, I should say, have made a collective decision that they can't win the next election fairly, so they'd rather cheat than compete.
Well, I think there's definitely a lot to what you're saying there. And the fact is that this is a direct attack on the right to vote in our democracy, all these voter suppression laws, and it is a strategy. It's not a coincidence that we're seeing so many states with so many voter suppression bills and many of them now getting enacted. It is designed, certainly, to limit who can vote, and that those who are being limited very much lean Democratic, traditionally disenfranchised communities, communities of color, the young people voting. And this is, I think, a crisis for our democracy right now. And what needs to happen as a result of this crisis in the face of it is that we need leadership, not only from the Senate Democrats who have the ability to move forward key legislation, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, to effectively overturn these state voter suppression bills, but we need this leadership from the president himself, President Joe Biden. You know, the filibuster former President Barack Obama has called a Jim Crow relic, and that it is. It has been used time and time again to block key civil rights and voting rights legislation, and it must come to an end. It must be abolished, and the path must be cleared for the People Act and the John Lewis Advancement Act to get passed out of Congress. And President Biden has yet to call for an end to the filibuster, as his predecessor, President Obama, has done. And I think it's time that he do so and use the power of the presidency to ensure that our democracy is preserved.
Well, John Boniface, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with John Boniface, who's the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as the legal director of Voter Action. A distinguished attorney, he has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles across the country for more than two decades and is the winner of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Award. And he is the co-author of The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side.